The frogs.
Bollocks.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome to episode 4 of the Frogs Bollocks podcast. We're coming to you pre-recorded from our spare room where we've got our microphones set up.
Yeah, we've got quite a little cosy setup going on now. We've kind of found our feet, found our zone.
Yeah, but almost halfway through already.
I know. What great stories we've had so far. Do you know what? I'm loving this, right? Because obviously when I go to work, I'm often, out filming. So I'm wearing very professional outdoorsy clothing. You want to be in your hat and your coat and everything else. I'm sat here in my spare room in my penguin pajamas right now.
Yeah, it's great. I'm just in my socks.
No, he's not. Just for anyone worried at home.
No, I'm also in my pajamas as well. So yeah, this is kind of the benefit of being freelancers. We can work at home in our pajamas. It's great.
This is mad. I know. I'm quite enjoying it. Well, this isn't really work, though, is it?
It is.
Is it?
We take this very seriously. Obviously, every single episode, we're there working really hard. You know, it's all serious, straight science.
Yes.
Yes.
Something like that.
Something like that.
Mm.
So, what have you been up to?
It's been quite a nice week, actually. I've had a really good time. Obviously, it was a long weekend for Easter. Happy Easter to everyone who celebrated.
Happy Easter.
I'm always surprised when those bank holidays come around because obviously being freelance, we work to a very different time schedule than most people.
Yeah, we don't really work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. We work all day, every day, or no day, every day.
Yeah, it's like busy periods, quiet periods. There's like no in between.
Yeah.
And when everyone's like, oh, have a good long weekend. I'm like, what do you mean a long... But where's everyone going?
Yeah.
What are you doing with your time off?
Yeah, it's so weird. Alien concept of bank holidays.
Yeah, it's nice though. Yeah. I mean, it gave me like a good excuse to actually relax because I'm like, well, no one else is working. It means I shouldn't work. I should work, but I shouldn't, you know. So we went to the garden centre. We've done lots of nice things in the garden.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of, planting.
Yeah. Planted some nice hangers.
Yeah.
We're getting some trees. Going to plant some trees in the garden. Mm-hmm. I was clearing out the pond. I think episode 1, we were just saying how stagnant the pond is and how nothing really lives in it. Well, I was clearing it out. I was getting some of the leaves that had fallen in, just getting some of that cleared. And I found a newt.
Mm,
a nice little smooth newt just there. I was like, oh my God, quickly put it back, obviously. I didn't mean to bring it up. I thought there was nothing in there.
Yeah.
And yet there was. There's newts in the pond.
It's amazing,
so
isn't
exciting.
It? It's really, really cool because we honestly thought there was no life in there.
No.
Pretty much. The birds come down to bathe in it occasionally, didn't they, and have a drink. But other than that, I've seen nothing in there.
Yeah, no. This is the first time I've seen any amphibian. So yeah, it's great. So that was probably my wildlife highlight. Have you got any from the week?
Yeah, well, we've had quite an outdoorsy week, haven't we? Mm. So on Monday, I was booked in to go for WWT up to the Flow Country, which is even further north than where we are in the Highlands. It's pretty much as north as you can get. And it is just this epic peat bog. And a couple of days before I was due to go, you got an email, didn't you?
Yeah.
To say whether you could come along as well to film it. I went up there and had a recording day session for a new series that will be coming out later in the year.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how much I can say about it just yet. But
yeah, is it embargoed?
I haven't had an official embargo, but it's,
still top secret recording.
It's the second series that I've done for them, so we're just starting up again. And, it's great to be up there in Flow Country, just exploring it and seeing what that habitat is like. And whilst we were there, we were obviously keeping our eyes peeled for anything and everything that we could see. And as we were on our way down after conducting a couple of interviews, we had male hen harrier.
Yeah. Oh, so beautiful. The ghost of the moors.
Yeah. Initially, we thought we saw one way off in the distance and we just saw this kind of grey, white bird.
Yeah.
Got the bins on it and it was a girl.
Yeah, of course.
We've all been there.
Yeah,
it
always been
all
there,
us.
But it's always worth a check.
Yeah. And then we're like, oh, give up. And then we kind of headed in the same direction of the gull. And then the shouting, hen harrier, and just look out the window. And there was this beautiful male just flying around. It was, pretty
epic. They're just so gorgeous. I think if you don't know what a male hen harrier looks like, Google it now because they are stunning. They don't look like any other raptor that we get in the UK. They are just gorgeous, kind of ghost-like birds flying across the heathland and peatland. And yeah, what a special encounter that was.
Yeah, very distinctive, aren't they? And it's great. Obviously, they'll be coming into the time of year where they're starting to do their famous sky dance, which is their courtship display that they do to one another to strengthen their pair bond. And then later on in the season as well, when they start having chicks and stuff, there'll be increasing amount of food passes, which is really cool. And this is when the male goes out and hunts, brings back the food to the female, but they drop it off midair. So you just see this, I don't know, whatever rodent they've caught just being flung through the air, and the female expertly catches it with her talons, and that's a really cool sight, as well as the sky dance.
Yeah, I've still never seen that behaviour, but I really want to.
Hate to make you jealous, but I have. It was good.
Damn you.
What the fact?
Ribbit.
Now, it's time for our classic head-to-head section, where James and I bring the very best story, science, wildlife phenomenon that we can possibly find to the table. But before we get into that, I have to hold my hands up and say that we decided collectively not to do a forfeit for every single head-to-head battle.
Yeah, we sat down and we started writing a list of different types of forfeits, and we only got to about three. And given we've got 10 episodes to cover in this series, and hopefully subsequent series to cover as well, we thought long term and decided we're going to do a forfeit for every series, not for every episode. So the Ghost Pepper Challenge still is on the cards, but it will be for whoever wins the entire series.
Yeah, so there will be a poll again after every episode comes out. So please still do vote. We want to know who you think was the ultimate winner.
Yeah.
And then we'll count it all up at the end of the series, and then whoever loses then will do the forfeit. But I will just say, last week, I still did win.
You did, however, have comments of people saying, I'm not listening to the podcast, I've just voted for you anyway. So I think there's some favouritism going on there.
No.
You know, I've got to work harder to win over the affections of the public. I get it.
But sloths are great. Sloths, you know, people just love sloths.
And sloths are great.
I think there is an element of perhaps mammal favouritism.
Okay.
Not Megan favouritism, but mammal favouritism.
Excellent.
I'd say.
Sure.
But anyway, shall we get on with today's What the Fact?
Yeah.
Okay, so the theme that we have chosen is hybrid. Now, just basically a very brief explanation of what hybrid is. It's an organism in biology where the offspring has resulted from the mating of two animals of a different species or cross-pollinating from two different plant species. So a hybrid organism will inherit half its genetic makeup from one parent and half from the other, producing an organism that has characteristics of both the parents.
Yeah.
But the parents are very different.
Yeah. Shall I go first?
Yes. Dive on in.
So for my fact, I might end up ruining one of the UK's most beloved birds.
That's a dangerous thing to do, James.
It's dangerous, but hear me out, because I think you will probably agree as to why.
Okay. Hit me with it.
So I'm going to be talking about the Henry VIII of ducks.
Okay.
So the Henry VIII of ducks, you might be thinking, oh, is it going to be, I don't know, a teal or a widgeon? No, it's a mallard.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
The common mallard, one of the most widely distributed ducks in the world. They're all across the Americas, all across the Northern Hemisphere. And they're ubiquitous with all watery habitats, ponds, lakes, lochs, lochans. And we love them. As kids, we would feed them. Well, we still do feed them. You know, we should feed them peas and seeds, not bread.
No bread, please.
No, it's like feeding them lots of Big Macs. They love it, but it's just not healthy for them.
We've
got this lovely relationship with mallards because they are one of the first animals we encounter when we're younger that gets us into nature.
Yeah, and you can build up trust with them, and they can come up close to you, and you get to see their beautiful colour and everything else.
Yeah.
So it's an accessible bird.
It is. But they are randy bastards. They are honestly one of the randiest birds you'll ever encounter. The males can be so forceful with their mating of the female that it can end up drowning her.
That's not nice, is it?
It's not nice. It's not what you want to do to your partner.
No, not ideally.
So the males are, like I said, they're randy bastards. They have a penis that is big, but in the shape of a corkscrew.
Ugh. ouch.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds painful. It's weird. It's wacky. But yeah, they have a very large penis in the shape of a corkscrew. Do you want to hazard a guess as to which direction?
I'm going to guess the corkscrew goes clockwise.
Anti-clockwise.
Anti-clockwise. Interesting.
Anti-clockwise penis. Now, it's not the biggest duck penis. That record is held by the lake duck.
Oh, yeah. And of course it is.
Of course, by the lake duck. Yeah, the lake duck. Yeah. Penis size is 42 and a half centimetres.
That's like as big as the bird itself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's absolutely huge. And it's massive. Actually the biggest penis in relation to body size of any vertebrate.
Wow.
So never mind your elephants with the big old schlongs. The record goes to a little lake duck.
Unassuming lake duck.
Now, the mallards have, like I said, quite a big one. It's corkscrewed. And lots of males will attempt to mate with a single female. They're supposed to be monogamous, but it turns out not so much. They can gang up on a female to try and breed with her. It's often that you see them at the lakeside flying and chasing the females around, just trying to get near her. Now, this is called forced copulation. Multiple males onto one female.
Yeah.
Forced copulation. And like I said, sometimes it can result in the females drowning. So it's not sounding pretty good to be a female mallard duck.
No, I wouldn't want to be reincarnated as female mallard.
As a male, you know, with the big old corkscrew, 42 and a half centimetres, you know, that's on my list. But, but for a female, not so much. However, she does have a bit of a win.
Good, so she's going to need it.
She's going to need it. So her anatomy is designed to fend off this forced copulation. So you've got the corkscrew, anti-clockwise shaped corkscrew male penis. She has a clockwise shaped vagina.
Right, yeah. Okay, that makes sense if you're trying to fend it off.
Yeah, so you're in the opposite direction to the penis to make it hard for it to get through. But not only that, she also has these kind of fake chambers and alleyways to kind of disorientate like a maze for this penis to go through.
Crazy.
Absolutely mental. And all of this is basically designed to reduce the success of this forced copulation. In fact, only 2-5% of forced copulation results in a fertilized egg.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, I guess it makes sense because females really want to choose where they're going to invest all their energy and who's going to be, you know, the father of their offspring, who's going to be the fittest. They really want to narrow down whose sperm to use. So, like, it makes sense, but that is a small percentage.
Yeah, small percentage. But yeah, like you said, they want to be able to choose who successfully breeds with them. And when they do choose it, apparently they can somehow control the shape to allow, basically, the best passage through. So all of those twists and turns somehow become blocked up and basically to create the safest, fastest way through.
Biology never ceases to amaze me.
Yeah, the evolution of a female mallard's vagina has come about due to the randiness of the males.
I love it. I love it. One of my favourite lectures at university was about sex competition and this kind of stuff. I find it just like fascinating.
Yeah, what drives evolution often is, you know, attack, defense, and in this case, randy males.
sex hormones,
exactly.
Yeah, it makes the world go round.
So with all of this going on, we know they're very promiscuous. As I said, they are the most hybridized duck in the world, so it turns out the males don't just have an appetite for other female mallards.
Right.
Any duck within their habitat is fair game when it comes to mallards.
They're just something else.
They're just something else. So, take a guess. How many mallard other species hybrids do you think are out there?
Well, based on the picture that you've painted, I'm going to think there is quite a lot.
There are between 30 and 40 hybrids.
Little devils.
It could be more because obviously, you know, a lot of this happens out of sight, out of mind. So there could be even more. On that list, teal.
Right.
A duck that is much smaller than a mallard. So that's pretty, that's a sad story. Northern pintail.
Ooh. Okay.
Shoveler. Widgeon. Tufted duck. Scaup. Wood duck. The list goes on and on and on.
God, what are mallards up to?
They have been very busy. So yeah, there we have it. The mallards are Randy Bastards and the Henry VIII of ducks, because it's mated, drowned, died, mated, drowned, survived.
Oh, God. I'm never going to look at a mallard the same way. I mean, I've seen them when they're kind of in pursuit of that kind of forced copulation. And it's not a nice thing to watch.
No, it's not.
You really feel for the females. I mean, I say you feel for the females. You can't put human perception on it, but... yeah, it doesn't look the best.
No, you do still feel sorry for them. It's a lot to go through. But then at the end of it, when it's successful, the cute little ducklings at the end in the pond are just so adorable. But,
yeah, like in nature, there's a reason for everything. So everything that seems brutal to us, there is often a very valid reason behind it. But what that reason is for the sexual promiscuity?
Yeah.
Yes, of a male mallard is, out of my realm of understanding.
Yeah, exactly. But, so there you go. The Henry VIII of ducks, beat that.
So I've gone down a little bit of a different route, and I've taken the theme hybrid, perhaps a little bit loosely.
Okay.
Because typically when you talk about hybrids, you talk about an example of sexual reproduction, which is exactly what yours was.
Yeah.
Mine isn't, really.
Oh, I'd like to see how you do this one then.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, but you have to kind of, again, think loosely around the term.
Sure, okay. That's fine.
Yeah. So as you said, within your example with the ducks, everything is driven by competition. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's competition for mates, food, nesting sites, it doesn't matter. Everything revolves around some sort of competition. And it's what basically drives evolution in many ways.
Yeah.
And I am looking at the plant versus plant eater evolutionary arms race.
Ooh.
Which is essentially, of course, plants want to defend themselves from being eaten. But then these insects want to develop the ability to be able to eat them anyway.
Yeah.
And go above that defense. So they're constantly trying to one-up each other.
Evolutionary tug of war between plants and insects.
Yeah, exactly. And the ways they go about doing this are mind-bogglingly mental.
Cool.
I find it really interesting. I love things getting one-up on each other. And then, you know, wait a few years to get the next level up. And, mm-hmm. Well, a bit longer than a few years. But you know what I mean. So I'm going to start off by talking to you a bit about how plants defend themselves. So some of the most obvious defences that plants have are physical, things like thorns and prickles, mm-hmm. and stinging nettles is a good example. So that can be for, you know, bigger animals that are coming to have a nibble at their fruits. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, when I go blackberry picking, I often get stuck by a few thorns.
Yeah.
And that's the plant's defense trying to keep hold of its fruit.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, quite a normal thing. And also for an insect, it's quite hard, you know, you have to move around all these thorns and things like that. So that's really cool. You know, there's something called a bonnet bell flower, which has a special layer of wax crystals so that nectar-stealing ants cannot gain the nectar. And the nectar is reserved for the plant's flying pollinators, like bees, which are much better at pollinating than the ants. So they're able to selectively choose which insect they give their pollen to.
Yeah.
Very cool. Another example is having things like trichomes, which are really small hair-like structures. These aren't so much physical barriers, but they're able to release chemicals. Now, these chemicals could be a scent, they could be a toxin, that basically just deters insects from having a nibble. And then there is another technique, which I think goes way above them all, because I find it really amazing that plants are able to do this, is that they're able to eliminate their attackers before the attacker even has the chance to hatch out and eat. So these plants are able to detect eggs that are maturing on their leaves and stems and destroy them, which is mad. So every egg that is killed means there's one less caterpillar and then one less adult that's able to feed on the plant itself.
Mm.
And the way they go about doing this is that the plant notices, or doesn't notice, but detects these eggs, and is then able to release volatile chemicals which attract certain types of wasps. Now, these wasps are the predators of the eggs.
Mm.
So the plant is essentially calling for the predator of the eggs to come, take the eggs before they've got a chance to hatch and cause damage.
It's like beaming up a bat signal or something. It's incredible.
It's remarkable. So all of these ways the plants have evolved to get ahead of their insect predators.
Yeah.
Really cool.
You've got to give more credit to plants because, you know, they're not just these green things that live lifelessly. There's so much going on in mm-hmm. plant behavior that we're only just starting to discover.
Yeah, plant communication as well. Yeah. That's a whole other realm. Maybe we can touch on that another
time.
Yeah,
exactly.
Your plants are cool. Very, very cool.
Really cool.
But the insects aren't going to let them get away with it.
Mm.
So there's always going to be a species which is going to try and one-up its plant prey.
Mm.
So scientists in Switzerland, Ted Turlings, has been studying the silver leaf whitefly.
Mm.
Now, it's a very small little insect. It's only about 1 millimetre in length. And it is native to the tropical regions, although sadly it has found itself in America and parts of Europe as a non-native.
Mm.
And it does quite take a fancy to crops.
Right. Okay.
So some farmers aren't very happy with this species. I never like to use the P word.
The P word being?
I'm not even going to say it. You know what the P word is.
Our audience might not know what the P word is, and they're now currently guessing and probably coming up with all sorts of things.
It's got three letters.
It's got four letters, including
the
P.
Oh, damn. It's got three letters, including the P.
The word is pest.
Oh, God, I hate that word.
Yeah, no, I agree. We shouldn't use really the word pest word. Because it implies that, that they're not supposed to be there or whatever. But
no, it's my pet peeve.
Yeah.
Worse than my pet peeve. I refuse to use that word. I don't use it in my vocabulary.
Or vermin.
Oh, God. Yeah, they're both equally as bad. Yeah.
Never use pest or vermin.
P or V. Banned.
Never P or V.
Banned.
Ban the P and the V.
Yeah, they're gone. So anyway, this tiny little insect is quite successful on its host plant. And it is able to cause damage by feeding and also can transmit some plant diseases occasionally as well.
Right.
Which is, you know, quite common in natural history when an animal is successful. So this silver leaf whitefly feeds on its plant by piercing the phylum or the lower leaf surfaces with its mouth, and it removes nutrients. Now, this does have a negative effect, as it would with any insect-eating plant, because it can cause the plant to develop these chlorotic spots.
What's that?
So chlorotic spots, so if you look at a leaf of a plant and it's middle of spring or summer, it should all be green, but there are kind of yellow spots in the middle.
Yeah.
It's basically an area of the plant that doesn't have chlorophyll.
Yeah.
So it's had some damage done to it.
Yeah,
and that can happen for various different reasons, but it's caused by damage.
Yeah.
In this case, from silverleaf whiteflies.
Mm.
So that's one way that they can cause damage. The plants also can wither and drop their leaves if the damage is severe enough. And they also produce this sticky substance called honeydew, which is what our aphids produce, which is then left behind on the host. And actually, honeydew can have lots of different purposes, great for ants and things like that. So it's quite a cool substance, but not great because you can't really photosynthesize if you're covered in honeydew.
Yeah. So in this scenario, the honeydew coating isn't good for the plant.
Not good for the plant, but good for other animals that may want to, you know, have a sugary treat.
Yeah.
So as a coping mechanism, the plants have produced these toxins in their leaves, which are meant to deter the silverleaf whitefly.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't.
Right.
Or not anymore, anyway. Because the silverleaf whitefly has been able to incorporate a proportion of plant DNA in its own genome.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So this is where the hybrid comes in.
This is where the hybrid comes in, because it's literally taken a bit of plant DNA through a process called horizontal gene transfer, which is simply the movement of genetic information across a normal mating barrier. And plant to insect is not a normal mating barrier.
No.
So DNA has been taken from the plant and is now in the insect. And it's quite complicated, but they think it happened because of a virus.
Right.
Very complicated. Have to do a deep dive into genetics, and that's where it all gets a bit messy. But essentially, these silverleaf whiteflies have plant DNA within them that is not just there willy-nilly. It's there actually having a really critical function. This seems to be the first ever example where this has ever happened, where this type of DNA transfer has been useful to the insect. So certain DNA transfers between plants and insects have happened before, but the DNA has not been useful to the insect, so it's not been used. Whereas in this case, they are actively using the bit of plant DNA.
And they're using it to avoid those toxins on the leaves.
Yeah, exactly. It helps them to feed without becoming poisoned.
Mm. That's incredible. So the fly has inherited some plant DNA to add to its own armory.
Yeah.
Where it can then defend itself against the plant's toxins in order for it to feed upon the plant.
Yeah, it's basically using the plant's DNA against the plant.
So this whole tug of war we mentioned earlier, this is kind of, it's gone really against the plant. This is how do you evolve forward from this? How do you
a different kind of toxin, perhaps, something that isn't, you know, related to that part of the genome or that part of the DNA.
You'll be well annoyed if you've evolved millions of years for this toxin. You've gone, oh damn it, I've just given the answer away. The antidote is just giving it to this fly.
Yeah, I know. You'd be frustrated, to say the least. That's why they're doing so successfully.
Yeah.
But it's amazing that we're still learning about this kind of stuff all the time. And whilst it isn't an example of sexual reproduction hybridization, it's a really cool example of kind of genome hybridization between a plant and an insect. I mean, come
that's
on.
Phenomenal.
When do you ever get that?
Okay, hypothetical question for you then.
Go on.
If you could hybridize yourself from a plant, what quality would you want to be gaining?
Oh, that's tricky. I think I'd like to be able to call insects to me.
Oh, okay, so you want that ability to...
Yeah.
The bat signal for getting insects towards you.
Yeah, because I spend a lot of my time looking for insects and trying to find cool wasps and anything that I can find, whether it be on the side of a wall or in a meadow or in a woodland, wherever.
Yeah.
It would be really great to just to be able to kind of put out a chemical signal and then for them to come to me and I'd be like, oh, that's nice.
So that's much cooler than mine.
What was yours?
Mine would just be to have the ability to not have hay fever.
Aww.
It sucks. I love spending time in meadows amongst grasses and plants and flowers, getting my nose in, looking for insects and filming. And yet the flowers just don't like me. They're attacking my sinuses and I'm sneezing and snotted and streaming and crying. And even though I've taken, you know, drugs for it, nothing seems to come close.
I feel bad because it is always the people that want to spend the most time in meadows that seem to have the worst hay fever. And I'm like, I don't get it, but so I do feel for you.
It doesn't stop me. I just do the really unflattering thing of shove a load of tissue up my nose and then brave the dangerous world of meadows.
I remember at one point, this was in Springwatch last year, and we were driving to location and we drove past you and you were, I don't know what you were filming, tiger beetles or something, but I don't think you knew we were there and you were just sat there with this tissue paper stuffed right up your nose.
Yeah, it's not very sexy, but hey, it means I can film the insects. It's fine.
Yeah. You've adaptations. Got your interesting ways of doing things.
Yeah, I'm evolving.
You're evolving. So there we go. What will it be? Will it be aggressive mallard sex? Or will it be the amazing plant versus insect genome mergation?
Amazing. We're going to put this poll on our Twitters as usual, or on our X's.
Yeah.
X's as usual. But there's going to be no time restriction for this. It will be up until the very end of the entire series. So whenever you're listening to this, you can get voting.
Yeah. And please do vote, because we will be doing a forfeit. It will just be at the end of the series. And who knows, it could be an even bigger forfeit than ever.
Exactly.
So please do vote. We still really want to know what you think is the ultimate example of hybrids/loose hybrids.
We've been getting some lovely questions from you guys listening at home. Please do keep sending them in. We want to hear all your questions, all your stories, all your anecdotes, everything. And ask us. Mm-hmm. We're open people. Ask us any questions you want.
Yeah. But you can email us at info@thefrogsbollocks.com. And I might put out another thing on my story.
Yeah.
For people to send in their questions if they want on Instagram. So if you'd prefer to get in contact that way, please do.
Yeah, exactly. So first question for you, Megan, by My Nature Snaps asks, would love to hear both your thoughts on reintroduction of the lynx to Scotland in the future. We've had quite a lot of this, you know, topic come up.
It's an important conversation, one which I think is gaining gravitas.
Oh, gravitas.
Gravitas. It's gaining momentum, and I think for a very good reason. We know, of course, that we are missing our apex predators from the UK landscape. You know, we used to have bears here, wolves, lynx, all of that kind of thing. But from a lynx perspective, so they went extinct about 1,300 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we miss them from the landscape. We miss the impact that they have as such important kind of ecosystem engineers, really.
Yeah.
Well, not even that. They're just really good predators. We know that we are overrun with deer numbers here. I love deer, don't get me wrong. When I see them, in most instances, I'm quite excited to kind of get a look at them. But there are way too many, and they have a really damaging impact on the forest and the health there. So by putting links back, you know, that would sort that problem out through something called the ecology of fear. And the ecology of fear is a really, really important thing within the natural world, whereby prey species are forced to move on because they don't know when or where their predator is. So it's that pressure of not overgrazing one area to such an extreme level because they constantly have to be on the move because they don't know when they're going to get an attack. So yeah. The ecology of fear is really important for any large herbivore grazing mammal. So that's, you know, one really positive reason to reintroduce lynx back. The other thing is they're actually really shy. I've had the privilege of working with lynx in captivity, and they are super shy. They like to be on their own. They don't like being around people. So that's a big misconception that they would be, you know, running around Edinburgh or something like that. They absolutely won't be. And we do have habitat for them. So we could have about 400 lynx in here in Scotland. And there would be room for them. Of course, they do range over quite large distances.
And you would never see them, like you say, that they're solitary and shy. You could release 400 lynx in one tiny reserve and you'll never see them. They're so elusive, so shy. They're incredibly agile, effective predators that you'd never see them. So they're obviously, there's a lot of skepticism, there's a lot of fear, I guess, with the thought of bringing back apex predators. But you only need to look across the North Sea over to Europe, and there are so many civilizations, so many countries living with and alongside wolves and lynx and living harmoniously. It's only because of the shifting baseline syndrome, you know, we've now gone several generations without these apex predators that we just no longer know how to live with them. And really, the answers are really simple, and we don't need to be fearful of this at all. You know, the benefits immensely outweigh any potential negatives. You know, there are thoughts on the impacts of livestock, but a lynx will prefer a deer over a sheep.
100%.
They've looked at diet surveys, and the amount of sheep in a lynx diet versus wild animals is minor in comparison.
Yeah, it is, but it's happened really successfully in other places. Like you said, we've had reintroductions across Europe, parts of Germany, we've got Switzerland, Slovenia. They've been put back, and it's working. And I guess the fear of the unknown in this country is so extreme that we're just so nervous about doing anything. I mean, it's only in Scotland where you can release beavers without a fence. In England, when you're talking about beaver reintroductions, they're put into enclosures.
Yeah.
I mean, what's that about?
The limitations are in our mind, not within our ability.
Exactly. And we really have to kind of focus on shifting baseline syndrome, focus on kind of that education. I think we should be putting lynx back. I really, really strongly do. Anyway, so that's kind of our thoughts on lynx reintroduction. But I have a question for you as well. So Chinton Barrett, who's a brilliant wildlife artist, has asked the question, how do bar-tailed godwits fly for 11,000 kilometres non-stop without getting tired?
Yeah, I remember when this came out. I think this was 2000s, where a male bar-tailed godwit was recorded flying 11,000 kilometres non-stop from the Arctic all the way down to New Zealand, which is the longest recorded non-stop flight of any land bird.
It's just amazing.
So we have our biggest migratory species is the Arctic tern, which literally migrates from the Antarctic to the Arctic every single year and back. The bar-tailed godwits are, you know, incredibly long migrators. And one was recorded doing 11,000 kilometres non-stop and was recorded flapping its wings for 237 hours. So that's, you know, nearly 10 days.
Yeah, but it's amazing, flapping. 10 days to get that far. I mean, that's quite impressive for quite a small bird.
Yeah, it's incredible. So bar-tailed godwits do have various adaptations which allow them to travel this immense distance. First things first is they want to basically put on as much weight as possible in terms of fat, because that's the energy source they use in order to keep flying all that way. Their pectoral muscles, that their wing flight muscles, grow immensely before they embark on this journey. But they also want to get their weight right, so they're putting on fat, but they don't want to be too heavy. So to kind of counteract this, they can partially absorb some of their internal organs, so their liver and their kidneys, and basically reduce their weight because they're not needed as much during this flight. They've already got the food and they've digested it. They've put on the fat. That's their energy source. They're not feeding when they're flying. So they've just got to use up all this energy to get them to the other side. Now, some birds have been known to show that they can sleep with half of their brain at a time. So when they're flying, like Arctic terns do, they can actually shut down half of their brain and rest it and sleep it, whilst the other one stays active where they can breathe and they can fly and they can keep going, and then they switch. Bartell Godwit, it's unsure as to whether they do this, so we don't know if that's an adaptation for them or not. But one of the biggest advantages that bartailed godwits have is they're really good at navigating through weather patterns. So they'll sense in the air certain weather, climate, any changes, which will help them get to the other side. So when the winds pick up in the right direction, they're like, great, it's time to go. And they basically get this tailwind, which helps push them all the way to New Zealand, which is incredible. So those are just some of the adaptations. We know some of them. We don't know all of them. There's going to be more, surely, within Bartell Godwits, which help with this massive migration. And that's kind of the beauty of science and nature, is that we don't know everything. We're still learning. It's kind of why we're enthused by everything, is we're learning all the time, and new science is coming out all the time. So something will come out which will show us more as to why Bartell Godwits can make a journey non-stop of 11,000 kilometers.
Yeah, remarkable. Birds just never cease to amaze you. And the thing is that the mystery of nature, that's the exciting bit, is that I would never want to know everything.
Yeah.
You know, I love not knowing things and just being curious and thinking, like, how does that work? Why is that doing what it's doing? And like, why don't Bartell Godwits get tired on that journey? Like, you know, even when you can explain it with adaptations, there's still a real magic around it.
Yeah.
So now it's time for the special part of the Frog's Bollocks, where we invite a special guest to come on and answer a few set questions that we've given to them. And this week, I'm really pleased to say that very good friend and just all round beautiful, beautiful human being who just brings so much positivity and light into people's lives is Sam Bentley. Now, Sam is the good news guy. You may follow him on social media. He's got 1.3 million followers, so he's very good at what he does. And he talks about positive climate stories and work being done to improve our environment.
Hey, I'm Sam Bentley, and I create videos showcasing positive things happening around the world that are helping to create a better planet. So one of the biggest good news stories I've seen recently is that the European Parliament have passed the Nature Restoration Law that aims to restore 20% of the EU's land and sea by 2030. And this includes restoring 25,000 kilometres of rivers to free-flowing conditions that help reconnect habitats, reversing the decline of pollinator populations by 2030 that we all know are crucial for balanced ecosystems and agriculture, and planting over 3 billion trees across Europe to recover degraded and deforested land. And there's so much more, but it's just such a huge move for the EU that I got super excited about it. Why is it important to keep positive? It's important to keep positive so we can best take care of our own mental health and also this beautiful planet we live on. We live in a 24-hour news cycle where the worst atrocities around the world can be presented to us on our phone screens at any time of the day. We are simply not wired to consume so much negativity, and it can be emotionally exhausting. It's also not a representation of what the day-to-day world we live in is. There's amazing people around the world doing things that don't make a clicky headline or a viral video. There's revolutionary solutions being thought up to some of the world's biggest problems. There are so many reasons to hope, and when we hope, we can overcome challenges way better than when we fall into a state of despair or apathy. So keeping positive, prioritising our mental health and resting are all acts of rebellion against the relentless exposure of negativity that's thrown at us every day. And that positivity can help us live healthier and longer lives while allowing us to best look after our planet. There's a few things people can do to help change the world individually. Firstly, one, getting out and voting is something that I definitely should have done more when I was young. I didn't realise the power of voting, but that's definitely something people can do. Vote for leaders who are creating positive change for our planet. And then also, depending where you are, if you're from the UK, for example, 80% of the farmland that feeds the UK is used to rear animals. So just transitioning slightly to eat more of a plant-based diet here and there can have a massive impact, because all that farmland that's used to rear animals, grow crops for animals, can then be given back to nature, whether it's for conservation purposes, to help reintroduce species, for wildflowers, to help our pollinators. There's so much that can be done with that land in the UK that we're just sitting, you know, sitting on so much potential there. So just by transitioning, even if you do meatless Mondays or you have mix and mix here and there with your meals, it just makes such a massive difference having more plants in your diet. And there's also so many health benefits too, to help live a healthier and longer life. If you were all powerful for a day, what's one thing you would do to make the world a better place? Wow, this is a lot of responsibility. There's so many things we could do. I'm going to refer back to one of the videos I posted that performed really well. It was about this school in India that was essentially designed with nature in mind. It was an all-girls school in a rural part of India that essentially helped educate, you know, a female population that probably wouldn't have access to that level of education at that age. So I think for me, if we could essentially create a bunch of sustainably designed schools across the world, helping with gender equality and getting access to education at an early age, and also the right education. I feel like now I'm in my 30s and I wasn't taught about climate change or any of that stuff earlier on. But I think having a revised syllabus, a worldwide syllabus that educated people on the planet, our impact on the planet, and also the solutions and what we can do to help it would be awesome. So yeah, my idea would be to create a range of sustainable schools to give everyone access to education at an early age with a revised syllabus, a solution-focused syllabus.
Isn't Sam just an amazing person? The work he does is just incredible. And he highlights just how important it is to stay positive. You know, there's a lot of doom and gloom. I think a lot of us are feeling the effects of eco-anxiety. That's, you know, quite a common thing at the moment. And to be honest, you know, we all feel it. You know, you and I have talked about it before, the eco-anxiety that we feel. And one of our coping mechanisms, certainly for me, is actually to kind of focus a lot on the positive stories, because there's a lot of negative stories out there. There's a lot to be kind of scared for. But similarly, there's a lot of really good stuff going on that gives us hope and gives us that kind of energy that we need to carry on.
Yeah, well, I think what Sam highlights brilliantly is that we have the solutions, and we know we do. We know exactly how to handle, you know, biodiversity loss and the climate crisis. We know what to do. It's just a case of getting on and implementing that. And I think Sam's work is so great in showcasing the people that are just getting on and doing things. And it brings a bit of light into the news feed. You know, when I'm kind of scrolling and I just get fed up because it's the same old negative story or negative perspective or whatever it is, and then I see Sam's happy face and glorious hair come onto my news feed and I'm immediately like uplifted, because I know he's going to say something that is going to be really important and empowering and make me feel motivated. So yeah, no, he's a brilliant human being, all round positive guy, as you might imagine from the content that he produces. But he has also got a book out, so if you're interested in that, it's called Good News, Planet Earth, What's Being Done to Save Our World and What You Can Do Too. So I really recommend you take a look at that. But as well as, you know, all of Sam's brilliant stories, I think he's also given us a question to answer.
Yeah, he has.
Should we listen to it?
And my question to you, James and Megan, is, I'm going to go a bit random, but it's wildlife related. I've really got into bird watching recently. Again, I don't know if this is something when you turn 30 or you get older, you're like, wow, bird watching, it's super cool. But I would love to know what, like, the beginner starter pack for bird watching is. Like, I want to know, like, is a particular set of binoculars I need? Should I get like a little rain jacket, a little pouch to hold a little bird book in? Basically, if I'm a beginner bird watcher, what would you equip me with?
Oh, I remember the days when I first started getting into birding, and I remember my godfather bought me a very small set of binoculars, and they were tiny, they weren't very powerful, but they really opened up that world of birding and just appreciating nature. So yeah, in terms of a toolkit, binoculars are really good. Now, you can get lost in the world of very expensive binoculars. You don't need them. You just need something. If you're a young person and you want to get out birding, any pair of binoculars you can get your hands on, secondhand stores, you know, anything, that will just immediately open up that world, get you closer to the species you're looking at. So that's number one, is get out and get some binoculars. But number two is really just immerse yourself in any environment. So birding, a lot of people focus on visuals. They focus on, right, I'm going to go and see something. Actually, think about what you can hear. go to an environment and just sit and close your eyes and listen. Because birding for me is more about the kind of engagement with nature than it is the tick list of nature.
Yeah.
I like to go out and close my eyes and just listen to the different bird songs that are around me. And, you know, you might be inspired to learn those bird songs, which, you know, which I've done and we've done through guiding. But similarly, just being able to appreciate it for the beauty of the eclectic, you know, avian orchestra, that's a very powerful thing as well. So get out there, immerse yourself in nature. You know, a pair of binoculars would be great. And to be honest, anything, if you go outdoors, any kind of clothing that will be suitable for a rainy weather, or wellies for splashing in puddles, you know, whatever it is, to just use your senses. That's the main thing.
Okay, so that's it. We've come to the end of this episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. And remember, the poll is live on our Twitter/X feeds now. So make sure you go and make your vote known.
Yep, I'm at James E.G. Stevens.
And I'm at Megan McCubbin.
And on Instagram, I'm james.stevens.photography.
And I'm at Megan McCubbin Wild, yep. I think.
And on Facebook and on LinkedIn.
Okay, stop now.
But you can also message us through email at info@thefrogsbollocks.com.
And if you're out and about and see some fantastic wildlife, we'd love to see it. So make sure you put it on social media and tag us, #thefrogsbollocks.
So yeah, we'll see you again next Friday, same time, same place.
We'll see you then. Have a good week. You are the frogs bollocks.